Hello, this is Debbie, back again on Wednesday, June 22nd, 2016, reading from the Decatur Herald and Review, E edition. Starting course on the first page. Education. Sutteroff leaves Decatur School on firm foundation is the headline. It's by Valerie Wells, one of the H&R staff writers. Decatur. Mike Sutteroff won't miss being on call 24/7. He will miss his co-workers, especially Administrative Assistant Joyce Brown, who's been in the position as long as he's been Director of Buildings and Ground, almost 30 years. She's the heart and soul of this office, said Jim Gortner, who will succeed Sutteroff after his retirement the end of June. She is, Sutteroff agreed, listing many, many things she keeps track of for him, like when it's time to do bleacher inspections. She'll retire next year, so Gortner will have the benefit of her experience and knowledge as he settles into his role. In November, Gortner was hired as Sutteroff's assistant so he could spend several months learning the scope of job with Sutteroff to guide him. I wanted to learn as I went along instead of one big brain dump. Gortner said, I didn't want to call Mike all the time. I want to respect his retirement. Sutteroff's background is electrical engineering, and he spent the first few years of his career at a nuclear facility. When he told a coworker he was taking a job with the Decatur School District, the man said, You're leaving this to change light bulbs in a school building? That made me feel bad, Sutteroff said. I wish I could talk to him now and tell him some of this history. His first job with the district was as an engineer, but he knew the previous director of buildings and grounds was retiring, and Sutteroff moved into that position in 1988. I, of course, wanted to move up, Sutteroff said. I'd been in the nuclear industry for 6.5 years out of college. In the course of his years at the helm of the department, he has handled everything from the construction of Hope Academy to extensive renovations in MacArthur and Eisenhower High Schools, additions at French Academy, Dennis, Franklin, and Baum Schools, Pershing Early Learning Center, and Thomas Jefferson Middle School. New carpet and paint at the elementary schools, adding computer labs and Promethean boards, and now removing them because the district is implementing one-to-one personal devices. Transforming Stephen Decatur High School into a middle school, then briefly back into a high school during the MacArthur and Eisenhower renovations. The district hired Phil Hazenfield as project man, excuse me. The district hired Phil Hazenfield as project manager for the renovations, and he took care of the day-to-day details, but Sutteroff was involved in every phase of planning from the first high school task force meeting in February of 2009. One thing Sutteroff is proud of is the money he has been able to save the district due to his diligence in searching out the least expensive energy options. When electricity was deregulated and customers could buy electricity from other vendors to be delivered by Ameren, he was one of the first to take advantage of it on behalf of the Decatur schools. Replacing light fixtures and heating systems at district meetings. Buildings has also saved energy, and in the course of putting the addition on Thomas Jefferson Middle School a few years ago, district maintenance workers discovered a chiller that had been installed but never hooked up. When it was hooked to the new equipment, the school was able to air condition throughout. Thanks to the 1% sales tax voters approved in 2010, the district has had more flexibility in capital improvements and roof replacements. For example, we're able to proceed at a faster pace than previous budgets allowed. The state is years behind on paying capital improvement grants, but Sutteroff said if those ever catch up, the district is eligible to receive millions of dollars due to the renovations of the two high schools. And Eisenhower has been certified Leadership in Energy and Environmental Design, or LEED, Gold. In retirement, Sutteroff plans to spend time on the family farm where he enjoys being outdoors with his wife, who is also an outdoors person. They've had to squeeze in such activities around his job. He's also looking forward to more time with his two granddaughters. He moved to Decatur with his family in 1968 because of his father's job with Illinois Power Company, now Ameren. Gortner holds a degree in construction management and is finishing his master's in civil and environmental in engineering. I think having a well-rounded background in building construction and grounds maintenance is really what you need, Gortner said. And this is the end of the article, which the headline in the hard copy says, Sotera fixing to retire, and shows a project in a picture that definitely needs fixing. End of the article. In business, on the front page, it says, small commercial drones getting clearance. White House clears small commercial drones for takeoff. This is by Joan Lowy of the AP. Washington. Routine use of small drones by real estate agents, farmers, filmmakers, and countless other commercial operators was cleared for takeoff by the Obama administration Tuesday after years of struggling to write rules that would both protect public safety and free the benefits of a new technology. The FAA announced the creation of a new category of aviation rules designed specifically for drones weighing less than 55 pounds. The long-anticipated rules means commercial operators can fly drones without special permission. Industry and government officials describe commercial drones as the biggest game-changing technology in aviation since the advent of the jet engine. This is a watershed moment in how advanced technology can improve lives, said Brendan Schulman, a vice president at DJI, the world's largest civilian drone maker. Jason Miller, an Obama economic advisor, said the rules are the first step toward full integration of drones in the national airspace system. Until now, commercial operators have had to apply for a waiver from rules that govern manned aircraft, a process that can be time-consuming and expensive. Since 2014, the FAA has granted more than 6,100 waivers, and another 7,600 are waiting for approval. Many more small companies have been using drones without FAA permission, say industry officials. Unless those operators make a serious mistake that brings them to the FAA's attention, there's not a lot the agency can do to track them down. The new rules would provide an easier way for those businesses to operate legally. The rules also would effectively lift the lid on flights by other potential operators who have held off using the technology. Ranchers who want to count cattle, research scientists and companies that inspect infrastructure such as bridges, oil platforms, and smokestacks. Under the new rules, operators would register their drones online, pass an aviation knowledge exam for drone pilots at an FAA-approved testing center, and then they're good to go. That's a big change since operators currently have to have a manned aircraft pilot's license. Operators also would have to follow many of the rules that apply to model aircraft hobbyists, like keeping drones within sight at all times and not flying over people or higher than 400 feet. Other important limitations also remain in place. Drone flights will be permitted only during the day and at twilight. Drone industry officials have long complained that restricting drone flights to daytime precluded a great many uses, like some search and rescue operations, agricultural operations best done after dark, and roof inspections of commercial buildings' roofs that use heat sensors. Operators could still seek waivers to restrictions like nighttime flights, flights beyond sight of the operator, and flights over people. The rules permit commercial transport of goods by drones for the first time, but the other restrictions on flights beyond sight of the operator and over people still apply. That precludes delivery drones flying across cities and suburbs, clasping small packages as envisioned by Amazon. Amazon and Google are working on drone delivery systems for goods purchased online. Google officials have said they expect deliveries to begin sometime in 2017. FAA Administrator Michael Huerta said the agency is searching how drone deliveries might safely be accomplished, but he declined to set a timetable for such rules. What's missing from the rules is an enforcement mechanism, said Sarah Krebs, a Cornell University professor. It's hard to see how the FAA actually can ensure that these rules are followed, she said. Congress has been prodding the FAA for more than a decade to write rules to provide civilian drones broad access to the national airspace. Initially, the agency put its emphasis on finding ways to enable larger drones like those used for military missions to safely fly at the same altitude as other manned aircraft. Later, the agency shifted its focus to small drones when it became clear that the market for their uses was developing much faster. The FAA's slow pace led frustrated lawmakers to include a provision in a major aviation bill 4 years ago, setting deadlines for the agency to issue regulations to safely integrate small drones by August 2014 and other drones by September 2015. The new rules fulfill that first deadline. The agency is also working on an array of other safety rules and standards to further broaden the circumstances under which drones can be flown. In April, FAA officials said they are working on regulations that would permit some commercial drones to fly over people and crowds based on recommendations from an industry advisory committee. End of that article. Continuing on the front page, education, again, Richland looks to select president approves budget. This is by Chris Lisvardi, an H&R staff writer. Out of Decatur. The process is moving forward to select the next Richland Community College president, but no announcement was made Tuesday as the college's Board of Trustees held its regular monthly meeting. Board Chairman Bruce Campbell said interviews of two candidates last week went well. He did not say specifically where the board is in the process or whether either candidate has been offered the job. Campbell said the board is working to proceed toward being able to make an upcoming announcement. The finalists for the position include Cristobal Valdez, who is currently president of Central Wyoming College, and Melissa DiNardo, who is currently the provost of the Community College of Beaver County in Pennsylvania. In the meantime, the board moved ahead with approving a budget for its next fiscal year, which begins July 1st. The college's budget does not include funding from the state because lawmakers still have not agreed on a budget, said Greg Florian, Richland's vice president of finance and administration. Interim President Chuck Novak is anticipating being able to save about $2 million in personnel-related costs after 35 positions have not been filled, including 18 full-time jobs. Other recent retirements contribute to the savings, he said. It will be an extremely difficult budget to follow, Novak said. It's going to be a difficult year. We need to prepare to run a referendum that would replace state aid. Novak said Richland can remain a healthy, well-disciplined institution despite the financial difficulties. One of the open positions will be executive director of the Richland Community College Foundation as Richard McGowan prepares to retire at the end of the month. Board members praised McGowan for his work, including most recently leading efforts to raise $3.5 million for the Carroll Center for Business project. The board met in one of the redesigned classroom spaces on the south wing of the college campus as testing of various design concepts is underway. Richland is working with BLDD architects to create different learning environments, both for classrooms and small group meeting space, before finalizing the long-term look of the area. I'll say that over again. Richland is working with BLDD architects to create different learning environments, both for classrooms and small group meeting space, before deciding the final long-term look of the area. End of that article. And the last article on the front page is Crime in Courts. Woman jailed for forcefully kicking kitten. Decatur. This is by Huey Freeman, a staff writer for the H&R. After a video captured a female in the act of kicking a kitten, 18-year-old Alexis Lowry was arrested on felony charge of aggravated cruelty to animals. She is being held in jail on a $10,000 bond. During his investigation, Macon County Sheriff's Deputy Shane Beck obtained a video showing someone kicking a small black and white kitten with such force that it could have caused death or serious injury, said a probable cause affidavit by Beck. The video, which was posted on Facebook, indicated that Lowry was the person that kicked the kitten. As an indication of Lowry's connection to the attack, she posted on Facebook, "I kick humans rear end too." When Deputies contacted Lowry at a relative's residence in Decatur. She was asked if she knew why they were there. "It's about the cat thing," Lowry reportedly told the deputies. In the video, the kitten is kicked by the right foot of someone wearing a pair of bright orange or red shoes. The deputies recovered a pair of bright orange shoes at the residence, which appeared to be the same ones as in the video. During a police interview, Lowry initially denied kicking the kitten, but later said she thought it was funny. She said she saw the kitten walk away. In order to explain her behavior, Lowry said white people view animals differently than black people. Beck wrote that Alexis did not appear remorseful as she was interviewed and continued to laugh that a kitten had been kicked and was severely injured or killed. Lowry was arrested about 9:15 Thursday and booked into a Macon County jail. She is due in court for her arraignment. End of that article. Continuing to A2 after having finished A1. Woman who defiled national parks banned. Woman banned from 524 million acres of public land. This is from a Tribune News Service writer, Louis Shahanan, Los Angeles. A San Diego woman pleaded guilty last week to 7 misdemeanor counts of defiling rock formations with graffiti in 7 national parks and has been banned from 524 million acres of public lands during her 2 years of probation. U.S. Magistrate Judge Sheila K. Oberto also sentenced Casey Knock at 23 to 200 hours of community work. A hearing to determine the amount of restitution Knock is required to pay will be held at a later date. Knockett declined to make a statement on her own behalf during a sentencing hearing in U.S. District Court in Fresno, federal prosecutors said. She was unavailable for comment later. The defendant's defacement of multiple rock formations shows a total lack of respect for the law and our shared national treasures, acting U.S. Attorney Philip A. Talbert said. The National Park Service has worked hard to restore the rock formations to their natural states, completing cleanup efforts in 5 of the 7 national parks. They expect to complete cleanup efforts at Death Valley and Crater Lake National Parks as weather permits. Charles Cuvelier, chief of law enforcement for the National Park Service, said the case underlines the important role the public can play in identifying and sharing evidence of illegal behavior in parks. The resolution of this case sends a message that those who would consider such inappropriate behavior going forward. Knockett painted colorful faces with acrylic paint and markers on rock formations with panoramic views in national parks during a 26-day period in 2014, authorities said. Selfies of her graffiti, signed with the phrase Creepy Things 2014, was posted on California hiking websites Calipeter and Modern Hiker and prompted an online petition urging the Obama administration to take action. The damage occurred at the following locations: Telescope Peak in Death Valley National Park, Rocky Mountain National Park, Colorado, Colorado National Monument in Colorado, Canyonlands National Park, Utah, Zion National Park, Utah, the beginning of the John Muir Trail in Yosemite Park National Park, and Crater Lake National Park, Oregon. The best-known artist who has tagged in a national park is Andre Sareva, an internationally known graffiti artist who owns nightclubs in Paris and New York, worked as a top editor of the men's fashion magazine, L'Official Homme's, and worked as top editor of the men's fashion magazine, L'Official Homme's, and has appeared in countless glossy magazines as a tastemaker and bon vivant. Nature lovers have lashed out at Sabrea on social media since his signature OX mark popped up on a large boulder at Joshua Tree National Park in California. He denied that the boulder was in the park. Answering critics, he posted on Instagram saying his work was made with love at friends' private backyard and not your national park. Readers then used Google satellite maps, latitude and longitude coordinates, and their own field notes to pinpoint the boulder's exact location inside the park. His attorney demanded that Modern Hiker take down an article about him, saying it made Sareva the target of oppressive and unjustified messages that seriously harm his professional and private life. Okay, it was his attorney demanded that Mark Modern Hiker took down the article, saying it made Sarajevo the target of oppressive and unjustified messages that seriously harm his professional and private life. Modern Hiker's lawyers replied that defacing a national park is prohibited under federal law and may be punishable by fine and imprisonment. The article remained at the website. On April 1st, Sarajevo paid a fine of $275 to U.S. District Court in Los Angeles, officials said. He could not be reached for comment. End of that article. On to the local section, state and regional. DeWitt County mental health provider to close. This is by Paul Switch of the Lee News Service. He's a Lee News Service writer. And his last name is spelled S-W-I-E. CH, perhaps it's Swish. Clinton, the primary provider of outpatient mental health services in DeWitt County, will be shutting down July 1st, a casualty of the state budget impasse, the agency executive director said Monday. The board of the DeWitt County Human Resource Center voted to cease providing services after June 30th, Executive Director Lynn Schofield said. The center is working with other Central Illinois health providers to determine whether they can assume responsibility for some programs. Our goal right now is to make sure our clients are taken care of, Schofield said. Then she paused to cry. And to make sure they're taking care of our community. That's our goal. Oh, and to make sure they're taken care of in our community. That's our goal. She declined to name the other agencies because negotiations are ongoing. It's truly heartbreaking the way the state of Illinois has set its priorities, Scoville said. I don't care what side of the aisle you're on. The Mental Health Board is saddened by the news of the HRC discontinuing client services as of June 30th, said Sharon Mills, administrator of the DeWitt County 708 Community Mental Health Board. There is no other agency in DeWitt County providing the array of services they do. We are working with HRC to see what we can do to help to reach out to other providers, Mills added. The center serves about 500 people in DeWitt County. Services include outpatient mental health therapy and counseling, case management to assist clients to live independently, 24/7 crisis intervention for people experiencing a psychiatric emergency, psychiatric services, mental health and substance abuse, early intervention, and developmental training, day programming for people with developmental disabilities. Some people with developmental disabilities work in the center's Encore thrift store. The center also owns and provides staff for Kleeman Village, apartments for low-income adults with mental illness, but the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development provides funding. About 65% of the center's money comes from the state and federal levels, 20% from local property tax money, and the remaining 15% from thrift shop operations and other income. But since June 30, 2015, because there's no state budget, the center has received no state grant money. A bank line of credit that was opened last year is not being extended. We're out of money, Schofield said, estimating the center is owed $150,000 by the state. The thrift shop will remain open until all merchandise is sold. Kleeman will remain open because it's HUD-funded. But the question is, who will provide support to clients? End of that article. Next article, education, mini campers introduced to nature. This is by Justin Kahn of the Herald and Review staff. Decatur, Jenny Carver wasn't through story time yet at Tuesday's summer mini camp adventures program at Rock Springs Nature Center, but 15-month-old Ella Carr decided it was time to explore. Ella headed for the door. Ella, Kate Carr, Ella's mom, said firmly, come back here. Ella, come back here. Ella's mom, Kate Carr, said. Ella listened, but was soon off again, forcing her mom to chase her down. This is how she's at home, too, said Kate, exasperated. That's okay, said Carver. Rock Springs Mini Camp head counselor Smiley, even if they don't look like they're learning something, they're learning something. The main goal of summer mini camp is to introduce children younger than five to nature, but that's not the only benefit, according to Carver. They get to meet other kids, learn how to interact with other children, said Carver, who has been in charge of summer mini camp since the program began in 2004. They don't have to always be sitting down. It's not school. A lot of times they come to some other camps and observe. A lot of times after they come to some camps and observe other kids, they start sitting longer. In Tuesday's Summer Mini Camp Adventure Nature Play Camp for children ages 1 to 5, the theme was Digging in the Dirt. Garver began by reading a story about gardening. Then kids were given real daisies they were allowed to tear apart and also look at with a magnifying glass. Then it was time to head outside and paint. All 10 children were given green paint to draw the stems and leaves and yellow for the flowers. Asher Marshall's picture looked like a flower as his mom, Allison Marshall, helped him, but then he used his fingers to make a more abstract piece. Allison quickly ushered him back into the building to wash his hands. When the children were done painting, it was time to collect the paintings and take them to dry. June Phillips, grandmother to Twyla Oliveira, laughed as she handed Twyla's painting to Garver. "She put it on thick," Phillips said laughingly. "It may never dry." It was Twyla's birthday. Phillips, who lives in Florida, came to visit for Twyla's birthday and went to the camp as something to do before a birthday celebration. After snack time, it was time to explore the flower gardens outside the Nature Center. Kids were allowed to look at the flowers through magnifying glasses, not pick them, and were introduced to yellow cone flowers, butterfly weed, rattlesnake master, and indigo, among others. But Ashley wanted to explore the yellow flowers he found on the lawn. "They're everywhere," he said of the dandelions as he picked two of them. "You're supposed to leave those in the ground. You're not supposed to pick here," Allison told him. "I picked them for you," Asher 3 told her. "Okay, but we're not going to pick any more," Allison told him. Camp ended, as it always does, with the fishy song. Next week's camp is Splash Pad, which will feature a field trip to cattail ponds to look for fish, turtles, and algae. End of that article. We'll end section one of the June 22 Decatur Herald and Review with briefs for Wednesday, June 22nd. Decatur, Heritage at Library. Embracing Our Heritage will be presented from 6 to 7:30 p.m. today in the Decatur Public Library on Franklin Street. Representatives of the Staley and Mueller Museums, Macon County Conservation District, Macon County Genealogical Society, and Macon County History Museum will be among those giving the program. Decatur again, Queen Pageant. Applications are being accepted for the Miss Macon County Queen Pageant, Junior Miss Pageant, and Parade of Princesses. A preteen division has been added to this year's event. An informational meeting will be at 6 p.m. Monday, June 27th in Decatur Memorial Hospital Classroom A. The pageant will be Sunday, August 7th, during Decatur Celebration. The winners will be the hostesses of the 2017 Decatur Celebration. Decatur again. No cooling help. The Illinois Department of Commerce and Economic Opportunity has announced there'll be no summer cooling assistance available through the low-income home energy assistance program offered locally through Decatur Macon County Opportunities Corporation. State agencies will coordinate efforts with local officials to provide cooling centers and other assistance to assure public safety during extreme heat. Decatur Symphony Guild. Sound of the Islands will be 3 to 5 p.m. Sunday, June 26th at the Beach House on Lakeshore Drive in Nelson Park. Sponsored by the Symphony Orchestra Guild of Decatur, the event will feature a full appetizer buffet, cash bar, raffle drawing for a strand of freshwater pearls. Musical entertainment will be by Ken Arnsberger, Master of Steel Drums. Tickets cost $25 and are available at the Beach House Decatur Arts Council or by calling 423-3189, 423-3189. Proceeds will benefit the Guild's music programs and the Millikan Decatur Symphony Orchestra. And lastly, under the local stuff, a Decatur arson attempt made. Police and firefighters are investigating after an apparent attempt was made to burn down a vacant Decatur house Saturday night. Remnants of a fire reportedly were found in the house at 1471 East Olive Street. And that is the end of Section 1, the Decatur Herald and Review e-edition on Wednesday, June 22nd, 2016. This is Debbie saying talk to you again soon.